AI Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
I want to thank everybody for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the one place where information never sleeps. Revolution, Revolution Radio!
All right, let's show them what we got here.
Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Well, howdy, howdy, folks. This is Dare to Think Out Loud. Today is July 24th, 2020, in the year of odd things happening. Hope everyone's doing well. We got a full panel today. My name's LB Bork. I'm kind of the guest, or host panelist, rather. I wish I was a guest most days. Anyway, yeah, we got Mike Gaddy with us today. John Breeson and Dave Scorpio. Starting with the last person, how you doing, Dave?
I am doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, no, thanks for joining us. John, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Mr. Bork. I hope everyone is doing well, present company included, and everybody listening out there.
Yeah, well, you're on tune today. In tune, rather. I'm, I don't know, I'm a little tired today, so we'll see how this goes. I'll be talking about some neat things. Yeah, Mike came up with the subject of international bankers and wars, not necessarily in that order, but I think it goes in that order. Mike did say wars and international bankers, but I think they create them. Don't you think there, Mike? Is that what you propose?
Well, absolutely, LB, and not only that, but these international bankers who have financed wars from the very beginning of America's existence are also the ones who are financing this wonderful pandemic we're all suffering under. So, you know, we can call this a war against the people if we will, but it's another war financed by the international bankers.
Yes, it's very detailed. I don't know, I was talking to Bruce a bit on chat this morning about how the Masonic orders such as Fauci. Oh, that was a great ball he threw out in that game, wasn't it? The baseball game this week. Maybe you guys missed that. It was kind of a sad situation. But guys like him are just useful idiots for the synagogue of Satan. And the bankers are all behind that, and a cabal, or a cabal, if you want to pronounce it that way. So I think we can all agree on that. But, yeah, it's very, very discerning. Or not, I don't know, unconscionable what they're doing. So anyway, where do we want to go with this today? Mike, did you have a program that you wanted to follow, or an itinerary?
Well, something along those lines. Of course, I really want John and Dave to jump in, and you too, LB, at any time.
Sure.
But one of the things I think we need to do is all of this parallels throughout history, the Bank of England. And the Bank of England was founded by William Paterson, and I believe it was 1692, 1694, somewhere in that era. And so he said that, look, creating this bank, we will enjoy the profits of all of the money we create out of nothing. So that is exactly, should be tattooed on every member of the Federal Reserve, because that's exactly the same thing the Bank of England established in that early time. But I think it's also critical that we go to and understand the name of the family we hear so often, involving international bankers, and that's the Rothschilds, and to kind of look at how this came about. And there was a goldsmith named Amschel Moses Bauer, and he opened a counting house. And, of course, a counting house, let's think of Ebenezer Scrooge and Marley in that context. And Scrooge ran a trading house or a counting house, pardon me. And so Bauer had a counting house in Frankfurt, Germany. It's basically the precursor to a bank. And he placed a Roman eagle on the shield over the door, which prompted the people there to call it the Red Shield Firm, which pronounced in German is Rothschild. Mm-hmm. So Rothschild's son changed his name, or Bauer's son changed his name to Rothschild when he inherited the business. And he quickly discovered that loaning money to individuals was profitable, but he soon found out that it was much more profitable loaning money to governments and kings, because it always involved much larger amounts, and the loan was always guaranteed by the public taxation. So it gives people an idea to look into the scheme of the whole thing. And once this Rothschild's son got the hang of how to do this with governments and kings, he set his sights on the entire world. And he sent out his five sons and taught them what we call today fractional reserve banking, or the art of money creation. And they were sent out to the major financial centers of the world to create and dominate a central banking system. And that's the banking system we still have today. It's the same core group. And we could go back to a French commentator who in the 1800s says there is but one power in Europe, and that is Rothschild. And so let's look at now, let's take this into the context of the American colonies. And by the end of, by the mid-1700s, Britain was at the height of its physical power, but it was also heavily in debt. And since the creation of the Bank of England, England had suffered four costly wars, and their total debt stood at 140 million pounds, which was a heck of a lot of money back then. So we also have to remember that one of those wars that England had been involved in was the French and Indian War, which was conducted in the American, near the American colonies or the American continent. And so by 1765, the King of England and Parliament had decided that they were so heavily into debt that they needed some help in gathering this money and to pay off this debt, at least to pay the interest to the bankers. So they decided that the colonies should be heavily taxed. So 1765, we have the Stamp Act, which comes out. And as I mentioned before, this little backwoods lawyer showed up for his first tour of duty in the Virginia House of Burgesses. And when he arrived, he was wearing plain homespun clothes. And they, at first, they wouldn't admit him into this regal event of the House of Burgesses, because he wasn't dressed properly and didn't have his powdered wig and all the other stuff. But this backcountry lawyer comes in, and he is quickly told, once he's admitted, that as a new member of the Parliament or the House of Burgesses, you were to keep quiet until you were spoken to, basically as a child. Well, this backcountry lawyer, that didn't fit him very well. And as we all know, that backcountry lawyer was none other than Patrick Henry. And so Patrick Henry first starts addressing the House of Burgesses about this coming tax, which the House of Burgesses had willingly accepted. And they had said, okay, well, you know, we've got to do it because the king so declares, and so we're going to do this. Patrick Henry stood up in opposition. And, of course, he was immediately called treason for his speech. And these people were taken aback. Where did this guy come from, and where did he come up with these crazy ideas? But anyway, in his presentation, he got the Virginia House of Burgesses to accept five of the seven planks he laid out to oppose this tax the overall taxation. And luckily, the word of this, what he had done at the House of Burgesses, luckily it filters out into the other colonies and it hits the ears of one Samuel Adams up in Boston. And he immediately jumps on what Patrick Henry had suggested, and they basically adopt it, and thus we end up with the Sons of Liberty. So we can thank Patrick Henry for lighting the fuse, which and he was greatly opposed, because once Patrick Henry left that House of Burgesses, the other members, the ones loyal to the crown, went back in and tried to dismiss everything that had been passed before, and they actually got one of them dismissed, took it off the record. But the record was already out, and it all seven planks made its way to Samuel Adams. So, you know, we have that. So that was, and so the bank, in order to make their interest payments, the British government set about that program to raise the revenues from the American colonies, as I just mentioned. And largely through that extensive program of taxation, the Stamp Act, the Intolerable Act, several of the other things that we know in our history. And so there was a shortage of coin at that time for minting coins in the colonies, so they began to print their own paper money, which they call colonial script. Now, this is different from the continental dollar, so let's make sure we pay attention to this. This provided a very successful means of exchange and also gave the colonies a sense of identity. Colonial script was money provided to help the exchange of goods among the people, the consumer, and the producer. It was debt-free paper money, and it was not backed by any silver or gold. So right. I'm sure there are people who will find a problem with that. And so during a visit to Britain in 1763, which was 2 years prior to the Stamp Act, the Bank of England had a meeting with one Benjamin Franklin, and you can find documentation of all of this in Franklin's autobiography. So Franklin said that he was asked, how would you account for the prosperity in the colonies? And so Franklin told them, and this is the quote from the biography, he said, that is simple. In the colonies, we issue our own money. It is called colonial script. We issue it in proper proportion to the demands of trade and industry to make the product pass easily from the producers to the consumers. In this manner, creating for ourselves our own paper money, we control its purchasing power, and we have no interest to pay to anyone. So America had learned that the people's confidence in the currency was all they needed, and they could be free of borrowing debt. That would mean they would be free of the Bank of England. So immediately, the king and the Bank of England hearing this, they go to the king and they say, we've got to make some changes here. We can't allow this system to be fostered in the colonies, and we have to do something. So in 1764, the king and parliament pass the Currency Act of 1764, which destroyed the continental script. And so then they come after in 1765, a year later, with the Stamp Act. So also from Franklin's biography, he says this, and I quote, in 1 year, the conditions were so reversed that the era of prosperity in the colonies ended and a depression set in, to such an extent that the streets of the colonies were filled with the unemployed. Hmm. So any comments to this point, gentlemen, or questions?
I just have one. I agree. You said some people might disagree to an un-gold-backed currency, but I don't. I've come to the conclusion through my research and whatever, I've run into people like Bill Still have told us a story about the history of currency or money, if you want to call it that. And I look at the gold currency as a way to steal and, it's always been an elitist way of backing money, and you really don't need it, as you just pretty much laid out with the colonial script. And like you said, a lot of people disagree with that because they're brainwashed into the constitutional principles. And I looked at what they did to get the states to collect all this gold, and then so they could steal it, and as the elitists do, because they favor this gold and silver medium of exchange that they put together.
Well, Go ahead, LB.
Go ahead. I was finished.
Well, you know, guys, we can go back to wampum, seashells. You know, we can go back to lots of mediums of exchange. But how many people are familiar with what they call the tally sticks?
Right.
And at one time, the tally sticks were a currency, and they certainly weren't backed by metal or in any way of that nature. And, of course, King Henry I produced sticks of polished wood with notches cut along one end or the other to signify denominations. The stick was then split full length, so each piece still had a record of the notches. And so the king kept one half of those sticks for proof against counterfeiting, and then sent the other half into the marketplace where it would continue to circulate his money. Mm-hmm. And because the King Henry accepted those tally sticks as payment for taxes, there was a built-in demand for those sticks, which gave people confidence to accept these as money. So, and they weren't backed by anything. So I think the history is there.
Right. Yeah, I understand the Spartans back in the day were of the same nature, where the elitist allowed the peasant types to have gold and silver at their whim, and they could control it, just as they have done here in the United States.
Well, here's another quote from Franklin, I think, Franklin's biography, which I think is, and it's autobiography, I'm sorry, that I think is very pertinent and relevant, and that is, and quote, "The colonies would gladly have borne the little tax on tea and other matters had it not been that England took away from the colonies their money, which created unemployment and dissatisfaction. The inability of the colonists to get power to issue their own money permanently out of the hands of George III and the international bankers was the prime reason for the Revolutionary War." Those are the words of Benjamin Franklin, guys, not mine. So there we have trying to get away from the international bankers created the Revolutionary War.
I want to circle back real quick to
sure
both what you said, Mike, and LB said, as far as the kind of conspiracy movement pushing the need for gold back and silver backed currency as kind of way of returning to that. It's my belief that the reason why you have people like Ron Paul go out and espound this so much is there was a book written, I can't remember the name of the husband and wife who wrote the book, it's called Gold Warriors, about the missing Japanese emperor gold after World War II. And it is my belief that these people that push the need so hard on like Counts for National Policy or even the John Birch Society, push the need for gold-backed, silver-backed currency is because they own a lot of it. They own a lot of it. And, I mean, look at the Hunts. The Hunts, you know, helped find the John Birch Society, helped found the Council for National Policy, the Hunt family, H.L. Hunt, you know, later Nelson Bunker Hunt. They tried to corner the silver market. They owned a lot of it. And of course, you know, they supposedly failed. But then again, you know, the government didn't seize all the silver that they owned. They loaded them into two or three cargo planes and shipped it to the Altiqua Bank in Switzerland. And some of that money would later be used to fund Al-Qaeda to pump up another, you know, war that's caused by the bankers for profiteering. So it's the same, you know, script, you know, play time and time again throughout history. And I agree with Mr. Bork that the reason why they want a silverback goldback currency is because the league control it. They control those precious metals and those markets of those precious metals.
Right.
It's just another way for them to become wealthy.
I totally agree, John. Very good viewpoint. One of the things I think that is critical to understand here is with the Currency Act in the colonies of 1764, then all of the interest that was required to be paid by the colonies to the Bank of England had to be in gold or silver because of that currency. And by the time the war began, Lexington in April of 17.
Here comes our audio problems. Mike, you're drifting.
All of the gold and silver in the United States had been sent to England as payment on the interest of the debt from the here you have America. You can't hear me?
Yeah, it's drifting, Mike.
Can't hear me?
No, oddly enough, it is drifting like it has in the past.
Well, obviously, this plan's not working.
Well, maybe not, but it seemed to be working before.
You guys
before,
go ahead and I'll listen.
Yeah, let's see if it comes back. I was just going to say that... Yeah, I don't know if we're being messed with here or not. It seems that way at times.
Oh, well.
Yeah. I was going to say one of the things I teach people.
Well, it's kind of strange that it depends on this.
I can't even understand... anything you're saying, Mike. There's only about one every four or five words show up, so I don't know what's going on. But anyway, I was going to tell the folks that when I tell people, let's say we're going to start over with the world system, and everything had to be backed on gold and silver, and some people or a nation didn't have any gold or silver, what place does that put them in? If they couldn't harvest the natural resource of gold or silver, or as John brought up, or even Mike said, in regards to a silver or gold-backed currency, some of these people already have the currency or the gold or silver to back things up, so that puts them in a good position. So in regards to wars, if a people didn't have the gold or silver, they're going to want to steal it or go get it from other people through force if they didn't want to produce it somehow through industry or some other means. So the gold and silver back currency is just really a bad situation. And I don't believe in it for that reason. And as we've discussed already, in the last 20 to 25 minutes, that it really doesn't need to be that way. A currency is based on a people's faith and trust that it works. So even if we went to a world system, it could be that way. And, of course, the people that keep the books would have to make sure it was delegated properly or, looked after properly. And that's the problem with most governments or systems, that you have to have honest people. And, of course, these days it's hard to find those people. You've been quiet, Dave. Do you have any comments?
Well, what's interesting is sort of the concept of money. What is money? That's actually a very complicated question, and there's many different answers that people have come up with over the years. And but clearly we are under the auspices of a criminal cabal, which is known as the central banking cabal. It's a criminal enterprise that they're running, and that's so the root of so many problems we're facing right now.
Yes, of course. That's the system. One thing Mike didn't cover is this system of charging interest goes all the way back to Deuteronomy in the Bible and the Israelites. And I have a theory about that. Of course, the synagogue of Satan, which is the current system that's in place, the Israelites are long gone. They disappeared over 3,500 years ago. And the people that are in control now are not the Israelites, but they've lifted that system out of Deuteronomy. And I believe that the directive from so-called that was given by God was, based on systems that other nations or people were following, considering maybe the Egyptians and such others that maybe were very careless with their spendings and money. And the directive out of Deuteronomy said that, if you don't charge your neighbor interest, your neighbor Israelite interest, when you lend him money, that you'll become rich because of the greed factor is not based in helping each other. And of course, they said something to the effect in Deuteronomy that you'll be able to rule over other nations if you follow this rule. And I think it was based in people caring Hello. For each other, not being greedy. Hey, Mike.
Hi, guys.
Yeah. Anyway, we got a break. I'll finish my thought after the break here on this Deuteronomy concept. Anyway, stay tuned. This is Dare to Think Out Loud. My name's L.B. Bork, and we'll be back after these station announcements.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyalty? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hand of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty! Oh, give me death!
A dark cloud is finally lifting across the world as U.S. military intelligence and their global partners are destroying the deep state criminal power structure that has ruled over our planet for hundreds of years.
We are free with the God-given right, and we shall not yield that right to any power on earth.
Hi, I'm Scott McKay. The world is at, and I am your host on The Tipping Point on Revolution Radio, where every Monday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, we bring you the latest in this ensuing takedown of this global criminal empire.
That's an image of strength.
You'll get the raw, hard truth here on The Tipping Point. So come join us Mondays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern in Studio B at revolution.radio.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
I want want to thank everybody for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the one place where information never sleeps. Revolution, Revolution Radio!
All right, let's show them what we got here.
Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Well, we're back. This is Dare to Think Out Loud. Today is July 24th in the year 2020. My name is LB Bork, host of this panel today. We have Mike Gaddy with us, Dave Scorpio, and John Breeson. And we're talking about wars in the international bankers today. And before the break, I was talking about Deuteronomy and how the Israelites were meant to treat their fellow Israelites. And I think the synagogue of Satan has lifted that principle, but they're using deceptive ways aside what the Israelites were taught. They were taught according to their directives in their covenant in Deuteronomy to treat each other fairly and don't charge interest. And they were allowed to charge other outsiders or foreigners interest, but they were not. But if my position is, if they did things according to not being greedy, that they'd be able to rule over other nations, because other nations were being foolish with their treatment to each other and such things as that. But the synagogue of Satan uses deceptive methods and creates wars and things of this nature, which you know, the Israelites were not doing. So these fake Israelites that exist now are not the same entity, not the same religion. And that's kind of what we're talking about today, how they deceived and, you know, do things to create debt to charge this interest. John, do you have any comments on that? Do you think I'm on point maybe a bit?
No, I mean, yeah, I mean, I agree somewhat. I still think there are Israelites that do exist. There are still Torah following and believing Jews that reject the Talmud, Kabbalah. But you know, there are Jews that are talked about in the New Testament, in the book of Revelation, the synagogue of Satan, God, or you know, or Jesus do not know whom they are, even though 144,000 Jews will be saved and converted.
That's what the book does say. I guess my point is, the people that are in control that Mike is referencing, that they're not the same ones that are of the Torah.
No, not at all.
I think we can agree on that.
Much so, yes. Yeah. You see the world order, you know, they control the banking, the city of London. They can control religion through the Vatican. They control a lot of the police state and the world government through both the UN and Washington, D.C. So I think those three pillars will probably be blended into one, I would assume, eventually, the way things are going and the way people are, you know, waking up and how quickly totalitarianism is setting in. What do y'all believe will be I hear the war drums beating since Trump was put in the office, and it seems like they're trying to do some quasi Cold War, maybe hot war with China, and it seems to be a lot of money being moved to support that. You have Steve Bannon on the War Room on his podcast talking about, you know, war with China. Yeah, Pompeo yesterday giving a speech that we have to go to war with China, calling COVID the China virus, whether or not it started directly from the Wuhan laboratory or not. That's up for debate. But, you know, them trying to pass a bill through Congress that if Taiwan is directly attacked or if China starts using continues to use aggressive tactics against Taiwan, then we go to war with China. So it seems like that's what they're pushing for. And whether it's a Cold War, which, you know, the last Cold War with Russia, a lot of that was, in my opinion, kind of like a play of some sort, that all the sides were making money and increased money for the military industrial complex and back-end deals and everything. So do you guys see that we're going to see a Cold War with China coming up, or a hot war? Or do you think that's in the plan? Or where do you guys see that moving?
Yeah. On, Dave. You know, well, John, no, I think it is in on the horizon. And, you know, I have a question for you. There's been a theory that's been postulated by, I think Joel Skousen is probably the one that's pushed it the most. And the scenario is basically this, that America enters into World War III against Russia and China and intentionally loses the war to hand over, you know, America to Russia and China. And then world government is decreed after that. What are your thoughts on that possible scenario, John?
It's possible. I mean, I've been listening to Joel Skousen for a while. Now, he is a Council for National Policy member, like his brother, Mark Skousen, their uncle, W. Cleon Skousen, the FBI agent. They're all Mormons. He helped found the Council for National Policy. He was a member of the John Birch Society. It's possible.
Yes, he is a Mormon. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I'm not pushing him, by the way. Just a question.
I know. I didn't say you were. I'm just trying to give context of why he may be saying those things. And I can see what Skousen is saying being correct. I just don't necessarily trust him because of his family background, especially.
I'm with you on that. Yeah, totally.
I don't know. I mean, I would see Russia siding with Israel. So who's Israel going to side with? If we're talking about it from a parapolitical standpoint, I mean, they've been trying to push three wars, have they not, Scorpio? You know, war with North Korea, war with China, and war with Iran. And none of them have really came to fruition. They've kind of just, there's been, you know, what they say, like rumors of war, you know, endless rumors of war, right? And you hear the war drum beating, and I'm not saying Trump's our guy or anything like that, but it's just very interesting of how nothing's been, no trigger has been pulled when you think that eventually one would have. And we know that Israel definitely wants to take over Iran and take over Syria reclaim the America to control a lot of the Middle East, and for Israel and America to put their puppets in the place over those countries. So I don't know. I mean, I know that they're pushing for our, you know, some sort of hot war with China, which I am no fan of sending, my children or anybody else's children's off for another banker's war. How do you guys feel about that?
Well, Mike,
I was going to say
concerns. Go ahead, LP. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, wanted to see if Mike is up and running again.
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, you're clean now, it sounds like.
Okay.
But go ahead, Dave, if you had something to add.
Well, the only thing that gives that theory some degree of credibility is that it's disturbing how America has intentionally, you know, sort of feminized its military forces, you know, letting in transsexuals and putting them in leadership positions. Whereas Russia and China have not done that, and their militaries are very strong, and I think they're ready to go. That's what concerns me about this.
Guys, can I make a point?
Yeah, go ahead, Mike. I was going to ask if you had one.
John touched on it, and I don't believe that most people understand how heavily federal agencies recruit employees from the Mormon Church. If you go into the leadership of the FBI, CIA, and a lot of other organizations, even the Bureau of Land Management, U.S. Forest Service, it is incredible the percentage of Mormons in leadership positions in those federal agencies. And that is something that slips by people, I think, a great deal. But recently, with Ammon Bundy assuming defense of the Black Lives Matter movement, and of course they are very much of the Mormon faith, and I actually had breakfast with Ammon Bundy and Ammon back in 2016, we met in Salt Lake City, had a nice breakfast and a conversation. And, Clive and Bundy didn't blame the federal government for what happened to him. He blamed the state government for not protecting him. So they do believe very, very strongly that the Constitution was inspired by God and that they will stand behind Romans 13. And I think that's one of the reasons that the federal government recruits so heavily in that faith.
Yeah, and, you know, Mormonism is a very powerful, let's say, empire that's, I think, connected to Freemasonry pretty closely.
Well, look at all the money they had. They had, there was something came out right before this pandemic came out about the money that the church had accumulated in Salt Lake City through a lot of nefarious practices. And the church was in, wealthy, beyond wealthy in their amount of money and assets that they actually held.
Yeah, it's crazy about the Mormons, like you mentioned, like you both mentioned, you know, there's very much a lot of evidence of the Mormon Church from its early inceptions with Joseph Smith kind of being a way of practicing Masonry and more open in how Masonry has infiltrated the beliefs, early beliefs of the Mormon Church. So you have a lot of that. And then just like what Mike said earlier, the intelligence agencies of the United States, as well as the federal police agencies, they love Mormons working for them because, you know, they really follow Romans 8, like Mike had mentioned earlier, as far as bowing to the government. There's many different interpretations of Romans 8. But they take it like that. So, and also because of their, you know, supposedly strong family values and supposed lack of corruption is the reason why they say that they join those said federal agencies. And you'll see that a lot. And the Mormon Church, it has a lot of power. It has a lot of money, like Mike had mentioned earlier. And they kind of infiltrate a lot of these alternative conspiracy, you know, type groups like the John Birch Society had a huge Mormon infiltration, as well as a lot of the Truth Movement, like Bobo Greitz, for example. He was a Mormon, or the Skousins, and they kind of try to steer anything away of actual talk of, you know, the collusion of the Mormon Church. At least in later times, at first, you know, at the formation of the first, I don't know how many decades during the 1800s, the Mormons were at war with the federal government. And some people actually still believe that, you know, they haven't forgot that. And they're trying to usurp a lot of the American government by putting, you know, Mormons in key positions, very similar to Scientology, I guess, you know, and the, you know, with Operation Snow White later. 1970s, very similar to that. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of people in the Truth Movement don't talk about the Mormon Church's influence on United States government or its influence in the truth movement. And I think a lot of that might be because there are powerful Mormons within both. So,
yes, I have to agree with John. He mentioned that they moved out west to really start their own establishment, and they got infiltrated by the federal government and, of course, taken down because of 14th Amendment aspects. But the case of Dyett v. Turner is one of the most prominent cases where they've discussed the Ohio Supreme Court discussed – or Ohio. The Utah Supreme Court discussed the disenfranchisement of state citizens based on the 14th Amendment. It's one of the only cases that really went into that, and that's the crux of my work is, basically the 14th Amendment taking over and creating political subdivisions out of the states as to the federal government. Of course, they still follow the Constitution as best they can, but it's a joke. Anyway, Mike, do you want to take us back on topic here with the war situation in regard to the banking?
Oh, sure. Give me a second to get back to my notes if you want. There was something, going back to Benjamin and an idea of issuing money, as Franklin put it, in proper proportion to the demands of trade and industry, and not charging any interest, was not causing any problems or any inflation at all in the colonies.
Right.
And this in unfortunately was alien to the Bank of England, and which only issued money for the sole purpose of making a profit for its shareholders. And then we can go into, if you want, we've talked about this in the in the war, and we have in 1781, after the Articles of Confederation were finally ratified 7 years after they were sent out to the states, and then immediately, because we're in the middle of the war, we come up with a financial system to finance the war under the Articles of Confederation, and so the Congress put Robert Morris in charge of everything. Robert Morris had deep connections with the Bank of England, as did Alexander Hamilton and James Wilson, all who were very prominent at that time, especially Morris and Wilson in the state of Pennsylvania. And so one of the first things that Robert Morris did was he immediately established a bank, and that was called the Bank of North America in 1781. And so Morris used money that had been loaned to the United States in the form of gold from France. And so he took that money that France had loaned to the United States and created this bank, the Bank of North America. Well, he didn't loan any money to the government right off out of that bank he had created, but he loaned money to a bunch of his cronies who, Gouverneur Morris, Hamilton, James Wilson, several others, George Reed, several other people in the Philadelphia area. He loaned out that money that they had gotten from France to give to his cohorts so they could buy stock in the Bank of North America. So once they had bought the stock back and they owned the bank, so to speak, then Morris started making loans to the U.S. government. So the interest off of those loans went back to Morris's cronies. And of course, we don't find very much about this in our history, and for obvious reasons, I'm sure. And what happened was that, just like all these other banks, within 5 years we get to 1785, the war's over in 1783, but by 1785 the country is hopelessly in debt, and so we ended up the value of American money in 1785 was dropping like a red balloon, lead balloon. So here we come up to what we call the continental dollar. And that's why we have the phrase, it wasn't worth a continental damn. Because they were reaping all of the money. And so the shareholders for this bank, Wilson, Hamilton, Morris, both the gouverneur and Robert, and several other prominent Federalists in the area, they walked off with the interest that had been paid by the government to this bank, which was created through nefarious means by Robert Morris. And again, we aren't taught about this, but this is what happened. And so this, so suddenly we have a huge problem in 1785. We've got a huge problem with all this interest and interest going to these people and made them filthy rich. And if you read Samuel Bryan, who wrote as Sentinel, you will see that he was one of the anti-federalists that caught on to this scam. And according to him, Robert Morris himself walked off with about $17 million in this deal. And so then, because the country is in trouble and all of these people have become filthy rich, is it not strange that the majority of these people who became filthy rich were the ones who ended up in Philadelphia creating a new constitution? So we, this is the part of history that no one's going to teach us, I promise you. So here we have these people, and they're complaining about the financial situation, and they're saying that they will not be able to cure without the Federalists go to Philadelphia, and they meet in secret and swear each other to secrecy for 50 years, and they create a government, and the very first power given to Congress, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, was unlimited taxation from unlimited sources. Any tax could be implemented and any percentage could be implemented against the people. That was the purpose of the Constitutional Convention. That is the reason not once did they consider the rights of the people, the liberties of the people, the rights of the people were never, ever a point of contention except from George Mason and from Elbridge Gerry and at times from Pinckney from South Carolina. There never was any mention of, hey, the people have some rights here. We've got to protect their rights. And, you know, of course, James Madison said, well, we don't need to protect their rights. And James Wilson said the same thing. We don't need to protect these people's rights because they have their state constitutions. And they have a Bill of Rights in their state constitutions. So that will take care of everything. That's what we need. That will take care of everything. So don't worry about it. And Luther Martin very adroitly stated, gentlemen, with the necessary and proper clause and with the supremacy clause, the Bill of Rights in the various states does not exist anymore. Because anything that the states come up with will be trumped by the, and I hate the use of that word, but they will be, it will be blotted out with these two clauses you have put into the Constitution yourself. And it was interesting to watch the wording as they put this together. Now, they went into, I believe it was Article 6, Clause 1. Don't hold me to that. But I believe that all debts made against the United States are valid. But they purposely left out all debts owed to the United States. Those were not mentioned. So they covered themselves with that. So if it was decreed that they owed money to the United States, that was once the Constitution was ratified, they were free and clean with that millions of dollars that Samuel Bryan alleges that they stole. So they put that in, and then they went into what was called the ex post facto law, and today we think that's a good thing, and I think that would be correct. But back then, once the Constitution was ratified, under the ex post facto law, the new Congress could not make any law which would make them pay back that money. So it becomes very intricate, and to get into this and to start taking it apart and to parse what actually happened there is quite, something else. But here, let's look at this. This happens. These people create a huge financial disaster and made themselves wealthy, and then they're the ones who run off to Philadelphia and say, oh, things are terrible in the colonies. We need a new constitution. If you don't find that suspect, guys, there's something really wrong. If the people can't see that the very people who caused a depression were running off wanting a new government to deal with the depression they caused, and then when you look at the assumption law and other thing that they enacted, they just made themselves even more rich, or richer, I'm sorry. So, but then once we get this government under the new constitution, once it takes effect in 1789, well, then right off you've got Alexander Hamilton, who profited richly from the bank. He opened his own bank in 1784 in New York, and that bank is still in existence, gentlemen. One of the only banks in America that has lasted since the very founding of this country. So Hamilton creates a bank with the money he got out of the sweet deal. And so, and I believe Hamilton left the Constitutional Convention on five separate occasions and traveled to New York. I can find nothing in 30 years of research that will tell me who he actually talked to. And we would never know that. Not because, you know, unless it was written down, there's no way we would ever know who he talked to. But why did he leave the Constitutional Convention five times and go back to New York?
And, kind of tells you it's a merchant's document or a banker's document.
Well, I think that's exactly true, LB. Mm-hmm. And then the only thing we have that we know is that from New York, Hamilton would send back letters while he was in New York to two individuals. One of them was Rufus King, and the other one was George Washington. So he would send back letters to them, and one of the letters that he sent back to King was very revealing. And he said, I know that you're nearing, this was in September, early September. He said, I know that you're nearing the end and there is something of addition that you're working on. And I want to make sure I get there in time to make it work.
On that, we have a break, Mike. We can pick up next hour. This is Dare to Think Out Loud. We got some station announcements. We'll be back in a few minutes. Stay tuned.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
I will defend myself against their tyranny. Number three is my radio broadcast. I'm squarely in front of the public all the time, and they all know what's going on.
For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence.
Hello, my name is John Wayne, and I do a broadcast here at freedomslips.com, revolution.radio, called The Unequivocal Truth, DEFCON 1.
Freedom and fear are at war.
And folks, I assure you, we are in defense condition one. As we journey perilously through this paradigm that we currently reside in, and I ask that you join me every Saturday, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, for The Unequivocal Truth, DEFCON 1.
Syndicalist commune. We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Yes.
But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting.
Yes, I see.
By a simple majority in the case of purely internal affairs.
Be quiet.
But by a two-thirds majority in the case of more...
Be quiet. I order you to be quiet.
Look, you stupid bastard. You've got no arms left.
Yes, I have.
Look.
It's just a flesh wound.
I don't believe I've seen such a display of courage, skill, nerve, grace, stupidity.
I'll do you for that.
Oh, what? Come here. What are you going to do, bleed on me? I'm invincible.
You're a loony.
The Black Knight always triumphs.
Roundtable Live, Monday through Friday, 1 a.m. till 4 a.m. Eastern Time. Bring your mind, bring your ideas, bring your voice. King Arthur had nothing on us. Here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the Internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution Radio! Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Well, we're back. This is hour two of Dare to Think Out Loud for July 24th, 2020. My name is L.B. Bork, host and founder of People's Awareness Coalition. I'd like to thank everyone for joining us. As you heard during station breaks, this is Revolution Radio, and this is listener-supported radio. And you'll hear things on this station that you won't hear other places because it is listener-supported, and there are no advertisers in that. We need your help. Please donate. Go to the station URL at freedomslips.com. That's freedomslips.com or revolution.radio, depending where you're listening. I don't know. There's various ways you can hear us. I wish I knew the list of how it works, and I should learn that. Someday I will. But anyway, yeah, we could use your donations. Go to those URLs and find the donation button at the top of the page, or you can send us snail mail. That's always nice. It's welcomed also. At the bottom of the page, you'll find an address to send that in Michigan to our manager, Terry. She'll be glad to take any money orders or checks in regards to donations. Or there's Patreon. You find the orange button on the webpage also. So, yeah, back to our discussion today. I did have one thing I wanted to mention in regard to what's going on. It's a quote by the Federal Reserve, Paul Volcker, back in the 70s, and it's one of the ones that really stuck in my mind. And he said, the standard of living of the average American has to decline. I don't think you can escape that. And I took average American as a middle class, as, you know, in the Communist Manifesto, they wanted to do away with the middle class so the elite can control all the finances. And they're doing a good job of that, I think. The last 50 years especially, we've seen a lot of manipulation. And like I said, we're talking about the banking today and the wars that are created. They've done quite a few wars over the years. I think it was Mel Gibson that said all wars that have been created over the years have been done by the synagogue of Satan. And I choose that language because it's a little more safe than the other language that's used. But I would have to agree with that to a point. The world bankers are the problem. And not only that, as Mike mentioned last hour, he talked about the Rothschilds and the Shield. Basically, they are the problem. If you look at the Rothschild Shield, you'll see three things on the family crest. It says harmony, integrity, and industry. And as we're talking about today, the money and the wars, but if you don't have industry and people working, you're not going to have money to be made. So that's why the shield of the Rothschilds touts, you know, harmony, integrity, and industry to keep everyone working throughout the world. And so they have merchant trade and commerce that stays afloat. And they tap into that in various ways. And like I said, Mike's subject or topic today was how they create wars to profit from. And, of course, in between the wars, they have to keep people busy in trade. And that's what I determined the Communist Manifesto was about, to destroy all people's economies and put it in the hands of the elite. And Marxism is basically the chaos they create. That's what we're seeing right now, is a bunch of chaos to maintain this system. Effectively, the communist system was installed over the last 150 years in the United States, but it's been in place 50 years. So what we're seeing now is just chaos created by Marxist-type values. And, of course, Marx has been dead, oh, gee, over 100 years. But they're still using the tactics of Marx and some of the Synagogue of Satan members that helped him come up with destroying the family and things like that to create more profits. And that's what we're talking about today. So anyway, Mike, you were saying something about how the instrument called the Constitution was put in place for these bankers and merchants to profit from. Do you want to continue on that
subject? Sure, LB. One of the things I think, you know, just to set a background, these people had established a bank called the Bank of North America in 1781. They had done this under the Articles of Confederation, and they had made themselves very, very rich. But by 1785, the inflation and everything else, and the money was worth nothing, and so the scrip money was worth nothing. So they had a huge problem, and they were able to say, you know, look at this problem. But it was a problem which they had created and a problem which had made them very wealthy. So they tried, under the Articles of Confederation, to get several bills through Congress to reestablish the government the way that they wanted it. But the problem was Article 13 of the Articles of Confederation, which stated that for any law to pass, every state had to agree with it. Well, on at least three occasions, they tried to push through legislation because some of these people were still in the Congress. And they were trying to push through this legislation, but lo and behold, one state and sometimes more would step up and say, no, we're not going to do this. We're not going to tax ourselves like this. So these Federalists, as they named themselves, realized that they could not continue to prosper and make themselves wealthy under the Articles of Confederation. They needed a new government. So off they marched to Philadelphia, get themselves appointed as delegates, and they march off to Philadelphia to create a new constitution. So now the new constitution takes effect in 1789. I think it's critical that we go back to a 1790 quote by Meyer Amschel Rothschild in 1790, the year after we have our new government under the Constitution. And Rothschild says, let me issue and control a nation's money, and I care not who writes its laws. So he says this in 1790. So 1791, what happens? These people who made themselves very rich under the Articles of Confederation during that war, the war of the Revolutionary War, then they move off and create a new constitution. And then 75% of those who created this new constitution are serving in that first government in 1789.
Mm-hmm.
So 1791, they create the first Bank of the United States. Now, how deceptive is that? Because they made the people think that the bank was part of the government because they called it the Bank of the United States. But try as you might, going through documents at the Library of Congress, you know, other places, you will not find anywhere where the investors who owned the stock in the first Bank of the United States are mentioned. They had learned their lesson because Sentinel had been able to track them down, Samuel Bryan, and he had accused them of stealing money because they had put their names on as stockholders of the Bank of North America. So under the new constitution, they put no names on any of the stock, so no one knows who those investors were, and it was never revealed. So here we have, within the first few years of this new Bank of the United States, the U.S. government borrows $8.2 million from the bank in the first 5 years, from 1789 to 1794. They borrow $8.2 million, and inflation in that time period hits 72% because of this. So this time, go ahead.
No, I was going to say another interesting clause in the Constitution was the full faith and credit clause.
Exactly.
That the United States could borrow money on. Which fits right into all this, right?
And I think this was the reason in 1798, 2 years before he wins the presidency, Thomas Jefferson, who had resigned as Secretary of State, made this comment because he was seeing it, and he was seeing it very well. And he said, "I wish it were possible to obtain a single amendment to our Constitution, taking away from the federal government their power of borrowing."
Mm.
So Jefferson saw this coming.
Right.
And so as with the real Bank of North America, the U.S. Bank, the Bank of the United States, the government had been the only depositor to put up any real money, with the remainder being raised from loans the investors made to each other using the magic of fractional reserve banking. When time came for renewal of the charter, it was only chartered for 20 years, and that's where we come back to another war. The bankers were warning of bad times ahead if they didn't get this renewed, but the charter was not renewed. The people saw a 72% inflation rate, and they saw that they were in serious trouble. And they leaned on their politicians enough that the bank was not renewed. So guess what? 5 months later, Britain attacks America and starts the War of 1812. Coincidence? I don't think so. So meantime, a short time earlier, an independent Rothschild business, the Bank of France, was being looked upon with suspicion by a fellow by the name of Napoleon Bonaparte. And Napoleon didn't trust Rothschilds, didn't trust banking, these banks, and he made something, and I'd like to read his quote. He said, "When a government is dependent upon bankers for money, they and not the leaders of the government control the situation, since the hand that gives is above the hand that takes." People, that's the very same thing that we're looking at in this country today, is because the politicians that you vote for and send to Washington are not in charge. The leaders of the government control the situation, and the leaders are not politicians, since the hand that gives is above the hand that takes. And as Napoleon Bonaparte continued, he said, "Money has no motherland. Financiers are without patriotism and without decency. Their sole object is personal gain."
Mike, that's a great quote about the ham that gives. Would you say that the Knights Templar were the first international bankers?
I think a case can be made for that, Dave.
Yeah, because I'm just curious how far back this pattern of control of central bankers, international bankers, goes.
Well, you know, we know that it started with William Patterson in 1692, 1694, somewhere in that era, at least as far as English history is concerned. Because prior to that, England was doing very well, but after the Bank of England is formed, England is suddenly in four wars over an expanse of about 50 years, and they're over their heads in debt. So obviously it started very early with that in England. But as for the Knights Templar, that would be an interesting discussion. That would I would like to, at some point in time, maybe we can discuss that in one of the programs.
Yeah, sounds good.
John, do you have anything? You've been quiet for a while here. Anything to add, John? Maybe fell asleep.
No, I didn't fall asleep. No, I was trying to.
Just kidding with you. I didn't think you did.
No, I don't have it. I don't have anything much to add. Mike was definitely on point. And
yes.
There's not much really I could say to any of that or add any of that. Thank you for the breakdown, though, Mike.
Yeah. I just wanted to add the Deuteronomy section. The Christians, of course, adopted the no interest. I know some Christians I've dealt with in recent times don't charge interest if you borrow money from them. Of course, the Knights Templar, Dave just brought up, being possibly the first international banking cartel or organization were supposedly Christians, but they really were interested in charging interest, weren't they, Dave? Or don't you know that?
What do you mean?
Well, if they were doing international banking, were they charging interest? I know the Bible or the New Testament people that, the Christians types followed, they usually don't charge interest. They adopted the Israelites' principle on that you don't charge interest on borrowing money.
Well, the Knights Templar, they were a semi-military organization as well. So, no, they did charge interest, and they had the muscle to back it up to anyone that didn't pay their debt.
Yeah, so that makes them Antichrist, I would say.
Well, that's a long discussion on the Knights Templar. It's a very – go ahead, Mike.
Well, I was going to say, Dave, thanks for bringing that up, because that is the very thing the anti-federalists said with all of these forms of taxation and a standing army to collect these taxes. We are in serious trouble. And Patrick Henry spoke on that quite extensively at the Virginia Ratification Convention. Very good point, Dave.
Yeah, and now we're seeing the spending completely out of control. They're talking about, $10 billion here for this, for coronavirus, such and such, and $30 billion for that. It's just like I've never seen anything like it. They're actually making trillions of dollars, new packages of programs to stop the virus, and it seems like they've just taken off any kind of constraint about running up the debt.
Well, I think that was the plan from the beginning. And, if I may, guys, I'd like to jump to World War One and to look at World War One, and what happened there was the fact the United States was not involved in World War One up until a point. But they were not involved in the beginning, and until the bankers went to Woodrow Wilson and they said, look, Germany is about to prevail in this war. And if Germany prevails, the loans that the United States has made to France and England and other countries will not be repaid. So we cannot let Germany win this, or it will be a great financial debacle. And so Woodrow Wilson then goes against all of his campaign promises, and he commits the United States to the war. And, of course, we prevail, and then Germany is put under the terrible rules and regulations, which led to World War II. And we hear a lot of things, again, jumping World War I, just going that it was a banker's war, and it was. And, ironically, around this same time, we come up with the Federal Reserve, and we come up with the three nonprofit organizations taking over education in the U.S., all of this in one time frame. But then, again, let's look at, I think one of the things we've been misled so much about was World War II. And naturally, Hitler was an easy guy to hate. I mean, you can't find many good things to like about him, especially the way that he has been portrayed. But was it Hitler who was responsible in the early 30s? I know he did some despicable things. I'm not defending him. But let's look at some other valid quotes that are very pertinent in this issue, and I think it will again take us back to the Bank of England. And let's look at a 1936 broadcast by Winston Churchill, in which he said, and I quote, "We will force this war upon Hitler if he wants it or not." That's 1936. Mm. That's 5 years before the U.S. enters the war. And then in 1936 to U.S. General Robert E. Wood, and this is documented, Library of Congress, Churchill says again, and I quote, "Germany becomes too powerful. We have to crush it." 1936. And then in a book, and I would recommend this book for those of you who like to have a nice library, Winston Churchill wrote a book called The Second World War. And it was published in 1960, I believe. It could be found at Amazon. And here was a quote from that book, a copy of which I have myself, which I find very interesting. And Churchill's quote was, "Germany's unforgivable crime before World War II was its attempt to loosen its economy out of the world trade system and to build up its own exchange system from which the world financial system could not profit anymore. We butchered the wrong pig."
Wow. Yeah, because I believe that Germany under that system was doing barter with countries, you know, trading, you know, beef for raw materials of some kind. And the other thing I found interesting about their economic system, and maybe all of you could comment on this, is that the Reichmark was tied to a unit of labor.
True.
And that had to have put some serious monkey wrenches in the machine there to do something like that, because no longer can you just make the money value whatever you feel like it at the moment.
Right. Well, I thought often that all property is labor. Everything comes from labor. All capital has to start there. Of course, that's the human resource end of it. Then natural resources comes from product or things of nature. So I think any currency should be backed on labor. I haven't studied it like people such as Bill Still has, but my thinking is that all money system, like Mike said, the faith of it has to come from the labor of a nation, you know, to keep it from being taxed or interest on it. And of course people could be enslaved on that notion too, so you have to be very careful on who's guarding the system, you know, or keeping the books, so to speak. Well, go ahead, Mike.
Exactly. And in my studies, one of the things I found, and I believe that without a doubt Churchill was a representative of the bank. And in a statement, again, this is can be documented, in a statement to President Truman of the United States in March of 1946, Winston Churchill said this following, and I find this very disconcerting. He said, quote, "The war wasn't only about abolishing fascism, but it was to conquer the sales markets. We could have, if we had intended so, prevented this war from breaking out without doing one shot, but we didn't want to." Who is we? And most people would think that would probably be England, you know, didn't want to, but I think it's the bankers didn't want to, because the profits that the international bankers make during war is just incredible. And you can certainly read a good foundation for that in Smedley Darlington Butler's War is a Racket, and where he breaks it down quite well of what happened in World War One. But here is another thing that troubled me when I started looking at this, was to look at so many of Churchill's comments. When I saw the first couple that I've read to you, it really troubled me. And I started saying, well, you know, I wasn't taught about this at any level of my education. And I look at a 1939, we're getting closer to America's involvement in the war, and Churchill said, "Not the political doctrine of Hitler has hurled us into the war. The reason was the success of his increase in building a new economy. The roots of war were envy, greed, and fear." I'm sorry, I said that was Churchill. I take that back. That was Major General J.F.C. Fuller, who was an English historian. So that was a quote from him. And then you have the London newspaper, the Sunday Correspondent, in 1989. We're getting closer to current times. And the London paper said, "We didn't go to war in 1939 to save Germany from Hitler or the continent from fascism. Just like in 1914, we went to war for the not lesser noble cause that we couldn't accept a German hegemony over Europe," unquote.
The two most important things I like to always reiterate on World War II were the creation of the United Nations. This is post World War II, the creation of the United Nations and Israel being founded or formed. I call it fake Israel. So I think that speaks volumes into world government and what they call the New World Order and basically the stair-stepping which has happened in regard to all these wars. Someone, by the way, in the chat room mentioned Wilson. Didn't he say, Mike, that he unwittingly destroyed his country or something to that effect in regard to banking?
He did. That quote has been contested naturally by government officials, but I think that quote was very accurate, and I think he said that.
Do you think he was a useful idiot or did something he didn't intend to?
I think all politicians are useful idiots, LB.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's hard to tell sometimes. Even Trump today, I honestly think he is trying to do some good things. And it's hard not to do things perfectly because you know what happens to the people that try to do things perfectly. They end up on the wrong end of a gun or not living too much longer, which is unfortunate. And that's why I say, we could push the politicians to do the right thing, but it's not going to get done if people don't do anything. And I guess you would call that the silent majority. They're really not being vocal enough. And the 8% of the Marxists are getting away with things right now. Anyway, we've got a station break. We'll be back after these announcements in about 2 or 3 minutes. Stay tuned.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take
the future is uncertain, I know this. Death is inevitable, I know this. But one thing is certain, as free men, it is our right to live unencumbered and in peace. And those times are quickly drawing to an end. And in these times, peace is certainly an illusion. And as the chains grow tighter, our ability to slip those chains increase incrementally with every passing moment. Inaction is no longer an option. It's time to raise our voices like a cacophony of thunder and lightning and tell the masters no more. And this is Nighthawk, and I say, for myself, no more. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, because the freedom is slipping away.
She
travels to Earth through the rainbow crystal bubbles from the furthest reaches of space and time, across the dimensions through the elements, and in harmony with the colors of the universe. Through her mastery of abstract stream of consciousness malapropisms, she weaves a web of comic, satiric, cosmic conversation. Her subjects can range from Norman, the goose next door, to astrology and Earth changes, and into the deep recesses of the soul matrix. She holds a wealth of knowledge on herbs, plants, and astrology. Join Mona and her guests on Adventures of a Feral Hippie as she touches the earthly radio waves 5 days a week at 2 p.m. Monday to Friday on Studio B at Revolution Radio.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
I want to thank everybody for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the one place where information never sleeps. Revolution, Revolution Radio!
All right, let's show them what we got here.
Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Hey, we're back. This is Dare to Think Out Loud, July 24th edition, 2020. My name is L.V. Vork, host. I'm with People's Awareness Coalition, PAC to some people. We're talking about bankers' wars today and how they create debt to a people, and them being a very bad thing. Of course, all this chaos that we're seeing today is part and parcel of what I call world communism, and it's all tied together to create a system of human resources. So people are enslaved to this system, and a certain elite control all the profits, and that's got to be broken. I posted an article called Beware the Merchants in the chat room, and someone made comment about merchants, you know, maybe not being bad people. Well, that's true to a point, or to a certain point. Part of communism is basically trade across borders, and communism, as we've seen, the corporations, for example, moving outside the United States and using cheaper labor has destroyed America's production. So the merchants, or the people that are doing the trade with these corporations, or direct corporate entities, are making all the profits, while the people of the countries are having their labor stolen from them, so they can't produce and profit, or, you know, make their own money. So this is all part and parcel of the world communist system to destroy countries and nationalities so there are no borders, and there's just, you know, a working class of people and the elite, and that's what my book was about, The Red Amendment. And the 14th Amendment is the main vehicle for all this. Of course, as Mike Gaddy has talked about, the Constitution was the foundation for it, but they really went into high gear by taking over with the 14th Amendment. And if you listen to people such as the Koch brothers, they praise the 14th Amendment and say a system such as that has to be installed all over the world. And well, I myself am against that because it's destroyed people's the workforce of a local nature and communities and local economies. And this pandemic is part and parcel of all that. They couldn't get it done enough with legislation under the Red Amendment and the Constitution itself, so they had to go with this worldwide pandemic to destroy any, you know, middle class or, you know, not middle class per se, but small businesses that existed. That's my story on that. I don't know. Maybe John has something to add to that, because we haven't heard from him. Make sure he's still alive back there. What do you think about all this, John?
I mean, I don't know. It's a very complex topic.
Yeah, it is.
I don't think inherently like credit unions are evil, you know.
No.
And I can understand from a local standpoint having a local credit union to loan out money and charge very little fair interest. I could see that to be appropriate for a banking system. So as
right. As Mike stated, the Articles of Confederation, or the colonies, had a banking script or a medium of exchange that worked. And that's one reason I think government, has to provide some medium of exchange for their people, because if you get a middleman or so-called capitalist involved, they're going to want to charge interest. So that is one point I think where you almost need a government so there's no greed involved, so you can control that. But the people that run the government have to be well guarded, and that's the problem with this system. I think when Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto and put the ruling class in charge, he knew that the power, I think it wasn't Lord Acton that said absolute power corrupts absolute, and I think it was made on Mike knows this. Was that true, Mike? Lord Acton,
yes,
said that
correct.
About
he made that statement in a letter to Robert E. Lee.
Right. So that was during the Civil War. So these guys knew about the absolute power. So people have to put a document together, not as a constitution, because as we discussed over the weeks and months past, the Constitution, and Mike brought it up again today, of course. The Constitution is a document to destroy people's lives and, you know, put money in the hands of the elite. But if we're to have a proper government, the people really have to guard the hen house and not these foxes, like Fox News, for example. Anyway, yeah, I have nothing against banking. You need some kind of banking. You need a medium of exchange to, do trade, because everyone's not going to want to beaver pelts or, whatever you might have that you're producing. So you need that, but it has to be well guarded and looked after. And that hasn't been done properly over the last 230 years or, much further back. As Dave brought up, the Knights Templar were doing international banking years and years ago. And it's been going on for centuries or thousands of years. So I don't know.
It has to be properly regulated.
Yeah. Mike, do you want to continue on any topic?
Yeah, if I may, and I certainly don't want to monopolize John and Dave here, which I appear to have done.
No, that's not a problem. I just want to make sure they have a voice,
Right.
But no, we're always interested in what you have to say here. You're a wealth of knowledge, no doubt.
Dave one time accused me, and I'll use that phrase loosely. Dave once accused me of being a forensic historian, and I actually took a great deal of pride in that comment and his explanation, because one of the things I have found is that if you want to understand history, it's a puzzle, and you have to be able to go find pieces here and pieces there where you wouldn't expect to find them and put it together. And a great illustration of that, as we're talking about this, and we're talking about bankers and us, is to go, and I found this in the transcripts of the Nuremberg trials. So this is the trials against to expose Germany at the end of World War II, and the chief accuser or prosecutor for England in that was a gentleman by the name of Sir Hartley Shawcross. And here is a quote from the Nuremberg trials, which I found very enlightening and a little bit disconcerting. So I would like to read that quote, and it is, and I quote, "Hitler and the German people didn't want this war. We didn't answer Hitler's various petitions for peace. Now we have to admit that he was right. Instead of a cooperation with Germany, which he had offered us, now stands the gigantic imperialistic might of the Soviets. I feel ashamed to see how the same intentions which we accused Hitler of are now pursued under a different name," unquote.
Wow, that's very interesting, Mike. You know, there's a book called The Young Hitler I Knew by August Kubizek, and he was a childhood friend of Hitler's and knew him as a young man. And the point I'm coming to is that years later, after Hitler had taken power, he invited Kubizek to visit him. And the very first thing that Hitler said to Kubizek was that, "I never wanted this war. It was forced upon me. I never wanted this war."
Well, from all these quotes, Dave, I think he was correct. Now, I believe that Hitler succumbed to what LB mentioned, the quote from Lord Acton. I'm sure that he did, and that was power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. That is why we go back and read, especially among the anti-federalists, was their thought of rotation in public office. No one should be allowed to serve, and it was in the Articles of Confederation. Today we call it term limits. Back then they called it rotation. And most of the people in the anti-federalists wanted 1 year term in office only, regardless of the office. They wanted 1 year and out, because they did not want to give people the opportunity to establish a corrupt network. And so, but the Articles of Confederation said that no one could serve in a public office for more than 3 out of any 6 years. Wow. And Thomas Jefferson spoke to that as well. He said that, you know, we can get the genius of society with rotation. And I thought that was a fantastic quote, because, you know, I would venture a bet today that we could pick up a phone book or a group of phone books and pick out 535 people, make 100 of them senators and 435 of them members of the House of Representatives, and we would be heads and shoulders above what we have there now. Yes. And just pick people at random.
It would be a civic duty, similar to jury duty.
Yes. And, you know, you go do your 1 year, you work for your society, and then you get your butt back to making a living, and you let someone else take hold of it. I remember when we had a term limits proposal in Arkansas, and a state senator, whom shall remain nameless, he said on Facebook, he said, "I do not believe in this term limit stuff, because it takes time for a person to learn the ropes and to be able to do everything that needs to be done as a member of the legislature."
And as a criminal.
And it takes time to become a millionaire while you're in office as well.
Yes,
so
exactly. But here the idiot made the statement on Facebook. He said, "Hell, it took me a year to find out where the bathrooms were." So I commented back and I said, "Senator, if it took you a year to find the bathroom, you should never have been there to start with." And amazingly, he blocked me. Can you imagine that?
Oh, geez.
Oh, that's
well,
funny.
That's socialist media for you.
Well, you know, that's an interesting idea about picking people out at random out of the phone book. I think we would be in better shape. And when was the last time that just an average working man was brought into office in the federal government of any standing, you know, a congressman or a senator? I don't think it's happened in a very long time, if ever.
Well, it can't happen, Dave, and the system is set up with the two-party system to prevent that. because neither the Democrats or Republicans is going to allow someone who is going to come into the party and upset the apple cart and actually talk about freedom and liberty. It will not be allowed.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Mike, there's a question I've been meaning to ask you, and you had just mentioned the anti-federalists a few minutes ago. What kind of government did they envision, the anti-federalists? Like, if they had succeeded in their aims to shape government, what do you think the government would have looked like under an anti-federalist agenda?
Well, Dave, there's no way it would have been perfect, because that's impossible. But the point of it is what they had no problems with the Articles of Confederation, and even Sentinel, Samuel Bryan, which we will go into great detail on Samuel Bryan on Sunday night. But he said that he had no problem with the Articles of Confederation, and yes, he understood that there needed to be some amendments to that, but he embraced most of the Articles of Confederation, which the people today would embrace without knowing they're embracing it. And the Articles of Confederation offered some great advantages. Of course, there was the rotation. No one could be in there for any more than 3 years out of any six. The people of the state had subject to immediate recall. If someone made a bunch of campaign promises and got elected and went to the state capitol or to the U.S. capitol and immediately voted for a bill that opposed that, the people could immediately summon them to come home and send someone in their place. So that, to me, was kind of a guarantee. Hey, you can't go up there because you elect somebody to the Senate for 6 years. It takes you 6 years, and how much damage can they do in 6 years? And how rich can they get? So that was the thing that they wanted, was they wanted that rotation, and they wanted the ability to have immediate recall. Okay, and don't we all want immediate recall today? If you go take your car to a mechanic and he botches the job, do you want to have to go back to him for 2 years or 4 years or 6 years? It seems that it's logical that the people would be able to say, uh-oh, you said you were going to do this. You didn't do it. You're out. And again, I believe, as you do, and Dave, that we could randomly pick people out of the population. What I would want to do if you did that is I would want to find not successful businessmen, but successful people who have worked their way and who actually know what it is by hard work. We have professional politicians, many of whom have never held a job except being a politician. Madeleine Albright was a great example of that. As Secretary of State, she had never held a public job in her life. Professional
politicians. Yeah, and I think Joe Biden's another good example.
Oh, yes. And look at Teddy Kennedy. Teddy Kennedy was the same way. You've got people who are there and have been in Congress for the majority of their adult lives. You know, Harry Reid was another great example.
Yeah, and Joe Biden was 27 years old when he was elected to the Senate.
And he's been there ever since.
He's been there ever since, except for when he was vice president.
Right.
So, hey, a rapper's running for president now.
Well, I tell you what, I actually believe my dog could probably make better decisions than the people we elect to office. And that's being tough on my
poor dog. Oh, it's a mess. But what do we do from here? You know, that's the question. We need to get people educated, and that's been my goal for the last 20 years.
We have purposely let ourselves get out of control. We have voted that control to a cabal of criminals. And we still think the way to fix that cabal of criminals is to elect someone else into that cabal of criminals.
Right.
At some point in history, I have wondered far down the road, if someone is examining the history of America, how many times they'll sit and shake their heads about the absolute ignorance and idiocy of the people in this country.
John, what say you?
Well, Well, I mean, I agree with Mike that if we gave his dog two buttons that he could press, one saying yes, one saying no, the dog would probably do better than the system of government that we have currently today. I mean, everyone speaking here knows that the presidents are picked. They've been picked for however long. And many people in Congress are as well. You know, you might have one or two people here and there get in, but those people are usually weeded out eventually.
As to what I just said, it seems like they like entertainment too, meaning the Americans. You know, they picked Trump. He got his TV show. They got a rapper now that is running for president, and it seems like that works pretty well for Americans.
Hey, John, I have a question.
Yes, Mike, go ahead.
And I know you've done an extensive study, and I would really appreciate your answer here. It is my contention, and I believe that Trump was placed into office in the 2016 election, and I do not believe that votes actually matter to anything. But I believe Trump was placed in office because this debacle that we have now had been in the plans for some time. And how do you keep the so-called conservative people sitting on their butts waiting for their master to come riding out on a white horse? And I believe they knew what they were going to do and what a great plan to keep the so-called conservative and especially the conservatives sitting on their backside waiting for Trump to fix everything while the whole thing goes to hell.
I agree, Mike. The Council for National Policy vetted Trump like they've done every president since Ronald Wilson Reagan back in 2016. Trump's speech out of all the Republican candidates was the only one that was not released by the CNP to listen to, so we have no idea what he said to them. But yeah, I mean, they wanted Ted Cruz originally, as the mythos goes, or maybe that's just his mythos, but later they switched over to Trump. Trump was originally going to pick, Christie for his vice president, but instead he was told to pick, the CMP's Michael Pence. So that happened. And I agree with you. I mean, if Hillary Clinton, they couldn't, the world order couldn't, you know, have Hillary Clinton win because people were waking up too fast under the Obama administration. So we all wanted change as Republicans and conservatives. They gave us Trump. Trump hasn't done anything in 4 years and won't do anything in another 4 years. And it was to placate us during this time period. It was to divide us. I mean, how many... The truth movement of itself usually leans conservative. It leans right. And so many of us are asleep right now, trusting the plan instead of trusting God's and trusting Trump as some sort of God emperor, as some sort of divine king, which he's not. If anything, we're getting punished for us turning away from God at this point. And, you know, people aren't investigating the corruption as much as they used to previously beforehand because people are trusting this administration.
I agree. Mike, you mentioned Sunday night. Why don't we go into that right now? You got a new program. Tell the folks about it.
Well, thanks for the opportunity, LB. It's called Addicted to Our Own Destruction. And Dave has been so kind as to basically be my producer for me and interject some wonderful content. And so we talked about corruption of the Constitutional Convention and how the lies that we've been told. So I would like to, and I plan to, on Sunday evening from 6 to 8 Eastern on Studio A, I want to go into in depth into Samuel Bryan and the Sentinel, into his writings, because he exposed more than I believe any other anti-federalist did. And ironically, in today's world, you can find all 24 of Sentinel's essays in a book on Amazon, and it's only $954. So I believe that is a form of censorship. And if you go on the internet, finding Sentinel's essays is not an easy task. You can find a few of them, but you can't find them all. And there's got to be a reason that they're being kept from the American public. And a little book with 24 essays costs almost $1,000.
Yeah.
That is obviously a form of control to keep that out of there. So I have all 24 essays, and I'm going to delve into that on Sunday evening. Would appreciate folks to come and have a listen.
Dave, your program on Saturdays, quick overview.
Yes, the Scorpio Conspiracy Show, Saturdays, 2 p.m., Studio A. And I just try to break down the hidden reality that's just below the surface.
Great. John, your program's on YouTube.
Yes, you guys can find me if we've read the documents on YouTube and we've underscore read on Twitter. And you'll hear Mr. Bork join me sometimes. Hopefully I needed a setup for Mike and Dave to join me sometime as well on my channel. And just having, you know, various discussions of different topics, mainly parapolitics.
Mm-hmm. And then there's my program, The Ultimate Remedy, on Tuesdays on Studio A, or in Studio A here on Revolution Radio. And I think that about does it for this week. I would like to thank everyone for joining us, and especially our host here or our panel experts. Are we experts, guys? I don't know. Maybe not. But we know something, and we know something's wrong, and that's what we discuss here every Friday from noon to 2 on Revolution Radio in Studio A. And that is the end of this episode. And stay tuned for more programming here on listener-supported Revolution Radio. And we'll be back next week with another exciting version of what we think to be the truth. Probably is closer to any truth you're going to see on the internet. Have a great weekend, folks.
Thanks, everyone. Have a great week.
Revolution.